I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Eric Nook. Eric is a clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, assistant professor of psychology at Princeton University, and an expert on how we represent and regulate our emotions. Eric, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you so much. Very excited to be here.
Thank you. So I think it would be interesting to kick things off by unpacking a quote you have on your website by philosopher Blaise Pascal. The heart has its reasons, which reason knows not.
Oh, yeah. This quote I first found and really connected with when I was an undergraduate. I remember an undergrad paper I wrote, I put it at the top. I think it's pointing at a mystery that a lot of us experience with our emotions. They seem kind of ineffable, difficult to understand. Sometimes we feel like they happen to us and we can't control them. And there's, you know, it can be hard to figure them out sometimes. Why do we feel what we feel and how should we manage them? But, you know, underneath that quote on my website and also in this paper I wrote in undergrad, I try to challenge the idea that emotions are reasonless or our heart behaves chaotically. And I think that affective science is really trying to unravel the mystery of feelings, of emotions, and develop a clear science of not only why we feel what we feel, but how we can healthfully manage those feelings.
Yeah. I think it's a great place to start because talking about sort of the science of emotion, it's something unique in that we all have, we all experience it and we all already have sort of ideas of it. But then, so we could talk about how a scientific approach to emotions is different from the way we normally conceive of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is something Lisa Fulman Barrett writes about a lot is we have these lay terms and lay understanding of emotions, and it can be so tempting to just port them into a scientific study. And there's utility in understanding why people have lay understanding of, you know, lay concepts of different emotion types. But there's just so much noise in the system and individual differences. As you're saying, we all connect with affective experiences, but maybe there's a lot of you know, idiosyncrasy in each person's mind that is worth modeling and really taking seriously as a scientist.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like by this point in undergrad, when you discovered this quote, you were already very much on the side of, I'm gonna take a scientific approach to understanding emotions.
Yeah, I think it was for a philosophy class with Patricia Kitcher at Columbia, philosophy of psychology, and we were, you know, reading about all of really, really old thoughts on emotions, and I decided to, you know, be like, what if we, you know, what if we push the envelope a little bit?
Right. I know your area of expertise isn't necessarily in the history of it, but do you know enough to recount a little bit of the history of how we used to conceive of emotions and how it evolved over time?
Yeah, I can take a little walk through. You know, I think one thing to know is that there's many different camps of how people think about emotions. So, but it goes way back. You know, you have Ekman and James and philosophers before that. You can think about even writings of Aristotle as being about, you know, defining different emotion terms. Kind of more modern approaches really emphasize questions of like, are there discrete universal emotion types that may have evolved to serve specific functions? We often think of this as like a basic emotion theory. You know, it's heavily influenced by emotion in animals, by Darwin, and expanded upon by Ekman and others. And then you have kind of another approach, an appraisal approach that is really interested in increasing the complexity of these different emotion types by saying, wait, you don't see universal discrete emotion reactions to different situations as a basic, a strong read of a basic theory would say. Instead, you see that how people understand or interpret these situations is really, really important. And so this kind of Schachter-Singer study way back when, showing that if you have people in a heightened arousal state, they will behave very differently depending on who's around them and how people are behaving, and even if they have the same kind of psychological or psychophysiological activation. So how we're interpreting our situation shapes how we feel. And so appraisal theory is all about kind of meeting out the specific appraisals. Is there a threat? Do I have control over the threat? Are there other people around? And how these appraisals combine to trigger different emotion types. And then kind of a third modern camp that we spend a lot of time thinking and talking about would be a constructionist approach to emotion, which really emphasizes idiosyncratic process of conceptualizing our affect and really valorizes and glorifies idiosyncratic and individual differences in how we think about emotions and construct an understanding of what emotion we're experiencing in every moment.
So those latter two approaches seem a bit more unique to humans or more focused on like our subjective experience, because there's a big sort of philosophical mystery with the more functionalist approach of like, if emotions are really just meant to produce certain behaviors, why do we feel them at all? Why isn't it just sort of this automatic unconscious process?
Yeah, it's a good point. There's also a lot of ink spilled on what different organisms may or may not be able to feel. One distinction that I find helpful is to draw a boundary between affect and emotion. So affect being the kind of vague, low dimensional sense, body senses that we have. Am I feeling more kind of positive or negative? So what's the valence of my affect right now? And then arousal, how kind of activated or deactivated am I feeling? And there are a few other low level dimensions that I would say are really very, you know, arise very early in the evolutionary tree, that those affective experiences, and also arise very early in our kind of human development across age. But then this is distinguished from an emotion, which is when you go through a process of conceptualizing that affect. Okay, you know, I just, you know, got an email and I'm feeling kind of, you know, very activated and very positive, I'm going to choose to label that as excitement. And that discrete, you know, transforming a ambiguous affective experience into a discrete type by applying emotion concept, that is a process that I think the constructionist model offers as an important part of the emotion generating process, which I think there's actually really good evidence is occurring. And that I think is a little bit more, I don't know if every organism that has affect also has the ability to conceptualize their affect and produce emotion, but where that line is drawn across age and across, you know, our phylogenetic trees, I think is not known.
Right. So affect is like the more basic neurophysiological response. And then emotion is like affect plus context or plus thinking about it.
Yeah. Plus a conceptualization process. Yeah.
So it's interesting that it seems to be a bidirectional phenomenon. Cause on one hand we have the affect starting and then we sort of conceptualize it and you get emotion. And that seems to be the more standard way of thinking about it. But then also as a clinical psychologist, you definitely know that the way you think about certain things can definitely change your affect.
Yeah, James Gross has a really cool figure in, I think, a 2015 paper summarizing his theory of emotion regulation, where you have thoughts and you have feelings and they're cyclically kind of feeding into each other. And then how you feel influences how you behave, which changes the world, which changes how you think about the world. And yeah, this bidirectionality of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and perceptions, it's all unfolding rapidly. It's an exciting phenomenon to try to organize a scientific approach to, because it just, you know, is rapidly disappearing under your fingers. There's a whole measurement question of, you know, how do we actually capture these things? It's hard, but I think it's really fun.
So did you come to your research more motivated by the clinical side at first, and you're like, I want to work with people and understand people, and then the science came later? Or was it more like, science came first and then you realize that a translational approach would allow you to answer some sorts of questions that you wouldn't otherwise have?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's kind of both, but I'll tell you the story. So I was raised in a town of 800 people in rural Iowa. My dad's a chiropractor, my mom's a veterinarian. I grew up in their clinics, you know, doing surgeries on animals and taking x-rays, and just was really into health science. And so I wanted to be a medical doctor. Went to college, took pre-med classes, was into them, but took psych classes and just really fell in love. And so I was like, okay, I want to, you know, I love the science side of things. Doing research with Kevin Oxner on emotion is like so cool. There's so much to figure out, but I definitely don't want to lose this commitment to developing a skill of health science and be able to, you know, work with people who are struggling and improve their help improve their lives some way. And so that just made it obvious to me that the next step was to be a clinical psychologist, where I can both, you know, be in the lab figuring things out, but also in the clinic, helping folks feel better. So it was kind of both, but I also came to psychology through philosophy. I just love these kind of big picture questions, which I can see you resonating with as well. Yeah, it's like, wow, I don't know. We've been talking and thinking about these questions for decades. Let's learn about what people have argued and then maybe add a new perspective at the same mm-hmm. time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for the clinical component, and then also looking at these questions from a more scientific standpoint. Where did the neuroscience component start to come into your research?
It's interesting that that was kind of an emergent property of being an undergrad in Kevin Oxner's lab. So, you know, it's a social kind of affective neuroscience lab, and Ajay Satpate was the postdoc who trained me, and he was a neuroscientist, and I started helping out with MRI studies, and it just became really appealing to think about using, you know, brain imaging as a tool to understand more about emotion. Ajay and I both kind of got excited about this language emotion overlap at the same time. And the first study I ever helped with, I did MATLAB coding to ask a very simple question, which is, when people are reflecting on their own emotions or other people's emotions, does it matter whether they get to make those ratings, those perceptions, on a continuous sliding scale versus a categorical kind of, I'm going to say I'm feeling bad versus I'm feeling good, or I'm going to say this person's feeling afraid versus they're feeling calm, versus a, you know, rather than a more continuous sliding scale? And the answer is yes. Actually, just drawing this distinction influences activity in the insula and amygdala, as well as connectivity with the, you know, prefrontal cortex, which is just mind blowing. You know, it's really cool. And it would be hard to develop tools to ask that question without looking in the brain, though. Since we ran these studies, Monica too at Columbia, who's Kevin's student, also developed some nice behavioral approaches to this question too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I got hooked after that.
You know those circles of emotions, and like the inner circle will have a few primary emotions with like kind of low resolution descriptions, like happy, angry, sad. And then there's a second layer with a bit more refined terms. And then the final layer is like all these fancy vocab words that are pretty narrow.
Yeah.
Would you call that more of a continuum, or would that still count as this categorical descriptors if we're talking about the outermost layer where there's a bunch of really more specific terms?
I think that if you're assigning a label to what you're feeling, going through a process of conceptualization and categorization. Yeah.
Yeah.
But instead, if you're asking yourself, like, you know, how good or how angry or, you know, rather than I'm angry versus not angry, that's more kind of a continuous representation. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. So then another philosophical question behind that continuum idea is like, when you ask a question like that, do we have some sort of like platonic ideal of what it means to be minimally or maximally angry? And then are we putting numbers in reference to that ideal?
Well, there's two ways I can interpret your question. One is within the individual, right? Do I have an internal platonic representation? And then the other way of interpreting your question is, at the population level, is there such a thing as a human platonic representation of anger? Mm-hmm. Empirically, I don't think we have a strong answer for the first one. Empirically, I think we might have a bit of an answer for the second one. I look at the data and I say, I don't think every human being has the same representation of what all of these words mean.
Right, definitely not.
I really don't think that's the case, but there nonetheless, there are scientists who would say, but I think there is something that it exists out there, an anger experience as a phenomenon. You know, so I think we're still debating. Debating. Within an individual is an interesting question. I actually, when I was gearing up to be an honor student, I did this kind of fun kind of undergrad science experiment where I went around to all my friends and everyone I met while I was on vacation or whatever. And I was like, I had a list of different emotions. I asked them to define them. And one of them I was really curious about was contentment. I thought I wanted to study contentment. And there are lots of different definitions of that term. For some people, it's just means happy. It's when you feel good, you're content. For some people, it's a very specific kind of, it's good enough, you know, like things aren't really where you want them to be, but it's good enough. And for other people, it's a very specific sense of it. To be content means things aren't all exactly where you want them to be, but you find a way to just embrace it as it is. Mm-hmm. And for some people, they use the term, those different conceptual reference interchangeably, or they have all of them in their head and they can map the word contentment to each of those concepts. For other people, they only think of one. And when I offer the other, like, oh yeah, I never thought of it that way. But, you know, so I don't, even within an individual, I don't think everyone has a platonic ideal. I think you can have multiple different senses of the same word.
Yeah, that's interesting. For content, the first thing that popped into my head was nothing to do with a positive emotion, but it was just thinking of the absence of negative experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. M.H. Tesler is a... he got his PhD from Stanford. He's a psychologist as well. And he has some interesting data looking at how people kind of map different affective terms to distributions of valence and finds lots of different, lots of differences. So for instance, one question he's asked is like, is our understanding of I'm unhappy and I'm not happy the same thing? And the answer is not really.
Oh, really? What would be the key difference there?
Oh,
I guess not happy is maybe more neutral and then unhappy is kind of more active. Is that right?
I don't want to spill the beans of his data too much. So I don't think
okay, that would be my layperson.
Keep an eye out for his work.
That's exciting. Yeah. I'll keep an eye out. So I'm guessing the answer is... I'm so sorry about... cutting out there.
No problem at all.
So I'm guessing the answer is both, but do you find that your work is more motivated by targeting these sort of global universals of patterns of emotion representation and regulation, or are you more motivated by understanding individual differences and in how people conceive of specific emotions?
I just don't know how we're ever going to do the former without doing the latter. Uh-huh. I think our science, I want to have a science that's committed to understanding how the idiosyncrasy of emotion representation explains population level emotional experiences. Does that make sense? Because I'm kind of giving up on the decontextualized, de-diversified representations of emotion and instead really saying, hey, what do you think this thing is and how does that explain your experience and behavior? And, you know, I think there's also kind of an anti-colonial kind of, you know, present moment, humanity situated argument for saying that we want to question the universality of some of.
Right. So like, what should these findings extend beyond weird societies, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's one aspect of that. Diversity that I think is really important to keep in mind.
So listeners of this podcast will know that I'm a big fan of personality psychology. So my mind often goes to thinking of like big five type theories that might explain these types of individual differences. So for example, differences in agreeableness might lead to differences in conceptions of anger. Maybe someone who's very conflict avoidant will get angry, but sort of like stuff it down. And then someone who's very disagreeable might get angry, and then you have conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you speak to those types of individual differences, either from a scientific or a clinical perspective?
Well, there's a lot to say there. And also, as a constructionist, I'm thinking about all the different, you know, idiosyncratic senses in which.
Maybe we should talk about that. What you mean by constructivist, and what as a constructivist, why you advocate for that type of view?
Yeah. So this, you know, this is the kind of third big camp of emotion that I was, you know, mentioning when you asked for the history of our science. So a constructionist approach assumes, first of all, this distinction between affect and emotion, mm-hmm. and then second of all, that there's huge heterogeneity in how people understand what different words mean, mm-hmm. which leads to a lot of individual differences in what when someone says I feel angry, what that actually means. Mm-hmm. And so I would also apply this kind of view to words like agreeableness, which I know there's a strong science behind, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. when you say an agreeable person might do X, I could mm-hmm. think of many different specific you know, instances where everyone's agreeable, but they're going to behave right. very differently, or the, you know, the particulars of the situation might look different. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by a constructionist. It's someone who's yeah. really embracing the messiness. Uh-huh. And the distribution, yeah. the heterogeneity of emotion and emotion words, and is kind of committed to the stance that universals, if they do exist, they're very basic, like valence, mm-hmm. And everything else. We shouldn't, you know, be dismayed when we can't find a universal. We should be excited because we're, I think, getting yeah. into the complexity of the phenomena. Uh-huh. So anger is a really, I love the example that you bring up. How do differences in agreeableness maybe map onto differences in how people represent and then manage an experience of anger? I think your example is right, you know, and this is also something that we think about clinically. I love that you brought that up. So people with social anxiety disorder come to mind. So somebody with social anxiety disorder might feel really, really, really anxious about having to confront someone about something, mm-hmm. Or really, really anxious that someone looks down on them. And if you're living in a world where you can't take up space, you can't be a bother to anyone, you're gonna, and any idea of doing that makes you so terrified, you're gonna avoid doing any of those things at all costs. Mm-hmm. You'll always do what other people ask you to do. You'll never raise a fuss. But you're likely to still feel anxious and upset a lot, and that might lead you to the clinic. And if you come into the clinic and you complain about all of these problems and I'm your provider, I'm gonna, you know, first of all, assess your symptoms and try to figure out the right diagnosis. And if indeed you do have social anxiety disorder, we'll spend weeks figuring out what that looks like for you, how your common thoughts and behaviors reinforce the symptoms that you're experiencing. And then we're gonna do the hard work mm-hmm. of saying, well, it looks like our habits right now are not serving us. We need to try new habits.
Right.
So we'll learn some skills to think about and interpret the world differently, but we'll also learn some skills to approach the things we avoid. Mm-hmm. So someone who typically feels angry at someone and then avoids ever upsetting them or ever bringing it up, we might assign an exposure where when someone cuts in front of them in line, you have to say, excuse me, I think you cut me in line. The back of the line is back there. Even though you feel really anxious about yeah. managing your anger or your kind of whatever affect is under the anger in that instance, even though your habit is to not, you know, upset anyone, we might encourage you to do so in order to learn that, hey, it's okay. It's okay. You can get through defending your turf. Yeah, hopefully that gives you a little yeah. bit of something to chew
Does
on.
That anxiety ever go away with this type of training? Or is it more like you reframe it as a lesser of two evils? And then it's like, both of these make me uncomfortable, but I decided that I'd rather be uncomfortable speaking up than uncomfortable, like letting my resentment stew.
Yeah. It's more the latter, though the intensity of the anxiety does go down because you learn, right? You learn that, hey, I can handle this. It's a little less anxiety provoking. But definitely with social anxiety, the motto is we're not going to get rid of this. We're going to help you learn to kind of live in the face of it. Because if you ask every human being, do you feel anxious about giving a speech in front of 1,000 people? Almost every human being is going to say yes, right? Like you're not going to get rid of the anxiety, but you're going to learn to perform in the face of it. Mm-hmm. And the more you perform in the face of it, the easier it will get, but the anxiety is not going to disappear.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. So here's another nature nurture type debate. We could use social anxiety as a case study. Is it typically brought on by like temperamental differences? Maybe someone is just very shy from a young age and then they build certain habits as a result of that. And then it manifests as social anxiety? Or is it more like you could imagine people as something closer to a blank slate, and then there are certain outside influences that cause these anxiety disorders to come up?
Yeah. I'm a both and kind of guy, you know, like, like we know, I mean, there, Jerry Kagan, all these folks have done all of this like temperament research. And then there's a whole theory in clinical science called the diathesis stress model, which is that, mm-hmm. you know, we come into the world or we have early life experiences or biological setup that kind of create little chinks in our armor. Mm-hmm. And then through experiencing certain life events, you know, certain, you know, things happen to us, or we observe someone react in a certain way that might tip off the system to lead us to develop symptoms. So yes, I think we know that there are genetic loadings on psychopathology, mm-hmm. we know that early life experiences play a huge role. I don't think people come in as a tabula rasa. We also have all of these systemic difficulties that people are exposed to different levels, depending on how they look or where they were raised or how much, you know, socioeconomic resources they have or what gender or sexuality mm-hmm. they have. These are also going to feed into the system in an early and ongoing way to set people mm-hmm. up. And then life comes in. And, mm-hmm. But I really think that you can meet all of this out in a very cognitive behavioral framework where you know, you have affective experiences, you interpret them in certain ways. And then the behavioral reactions you have either reinforce the belief of, oh no, I can't handle the anxiety of, you know, pushing back on someone, or, oh no, actually, I think next time I can give that a try, even though it's a little bit stressful. Mm-hmm. And that will shape trajectories of your symptomatology, and it's knitted within your community and your culture and all of that.
Mm-hmm. In clinical science, is there an idea of like a breaking point or a threshold at which stress becomes too much? So what I mean by this is like, to some extent, it seems like when people stress themselves, they're going to grow from it and realize, oh, I could handle this. But then if there's too much, I guess just at some point, there's like a tipping point. Is there a technical term for whatever that tipping point might be?
There's all of this is under active debate, I think, but there's room to back up each of the claims you just made and room to argue against it, right? So there's people studying post-traumatic growth. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people experience both big T trauma, you know, these really, really devastating experiences, as well as where you might think you're about to die or see someone die or, mm-hmm. you know, have your body integrity violated in some way. But then also little T traumas where people are like, discriminating against you for some reason or mm-hmm. other small things that happen. These are happening all the time, and not everyone has PTSD. So there's obviously individual differences in how people respond to these traumas. And we've identified some of the different predictors of what helps people get through versus develop a symptomatic response. But is there some absolute threshold is the question you're asking, by which anyone who experiences this kind of thing is definitely going to develop a form of psychopathology? No, I don't think so. There's a lot of... the diathesis stress model says that some people are going to come in with a little bit more susceptibility to developing that. And some people are not, even when you're exposed to the same.
Uh-huh.
situation.
So then even if there's no general sort of limit, would there be for each individual, everyone would have this sort of tipping point?
That's interesting. Maybe. I'd still say that it's highly sensitive to contextual influence. Yeah. And that's proven by the fact that therapy works, right? You can shift someone's tipping point.
Right. So there are certain clinical ideas. Resilience is a good example where it seems like more is better. So if there are temperamental differences in that, it seems like if you're born more resilient, or if you're raised in the right environment that makes you more resilient, it's just a win for you. Are there any advantages to lower resilience or higher anxiety or things like that? Or is it just bad luck?
I really am struggling to think of the name of it, but there are these models of kind of stress response where some people are thought of as like dandelions and some people are thought of as orchids. Mm-hmm. Dandelions are much less environmentally susceptible. They'll kind of like hang out and get through regardless of whether they're in a really difficult environment or a really resource rich and supportive environment. Mm-hmm. And then there are other folks, orchids, where there's the difference between the high sensitivity to environment leads to vastly different phenotypes that are kind of on the extremes, either really, really struggling or really, really thriving. So I think that is the kind of flip side of, I wouldn't call it low resilience, I would call it like high kind of environmental sensitivity, is like in the right environment, you're really gonna thrive. Potentially more than someone who is less engaged with the environment.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's interesting though. I would have thought the metaphor went the other way, because like a dandelion is like, you know, a slight breeze set you off in one direction.
Oh yeah, when you have the flower. Yeah. No. I get that.
Yeah. So maybe we could talk at this point about how your clinical training or clinical experiences have influenced some of your research. Like, are there any particular questions that you think you came to that you wouldn't have otherwise if you were just doing the straight neuroscience work?
One thing that my clinical training has helped me notice is just the gap between what we're doing and kind of getting this in the hands of therapists. Like I'm mm-hmm. much more aware of that. You know, I used to think like, oh, clinical research is giving someone a depression questionnaire. It's like, no, there's so much more nuance. And here's another space for the constructionist way of thinking to inform the way we do research. Mm-hmm. When someone says I'm depressed, that can mean so many different things. And even when someone is given the diagnosis of depression, that can mean so many different things. This is mm-hmm. not a unitary, categorical, universal experience, you know, mm-hmm. phenomenon. So so that's one way it's informed my thinking, is like, oh, we've got a lot of work to do to really mm-hmm. Push the envelope. It's also exposed me to new ways, new ideas that I'm doing some writing about, but you know, the research process is just so slow. I'm only kind of writing about these things now. Mm-hmm. So I actually just submitted a paper on narcissism.
Oh, wow.
And a cognitive behavioral formulation, narcissistic processes and narcissistic treatment, which mm-hmm. I'm really excited about, but I definitely would not have known anything about that or had the kind of chops to write about it had mm-hmm. I not spent a year working at the Gunderson Residence at McLean with Lois Trinkin.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. Yeah. Next month, I'm interviewing W. Keith Campbell. Did you come up across any of his work doing that?
I may have. It's not coming to mind immediately, but this is a narcissism.
He's got a book called The New Science of Narcissism.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Yeah. That's great. And then there's also I'll have to keep an eye out for that. That's exciting. I have a theory paper that I'm also working on with Jamil Zaki, who supervised me when I was postdoc, looking at empathy regulation in the context of exposure therapy, which also mm-hmm. I would not have known anything about had I not, you know, spent many, many years doing exposure exercises with patients.
That's interesting. What does that mean?
The argument we're offering is that a lot of the clinical literature suggests more empathy is better. If you have mm-hmm. a more empathic therapist, you're going to get better in treatment. And when you look at the data, actually, that's not always the case, especially when you're doing anxiety exposure-based treatment for anxiety. More empathically oriented therapists actually have worse outcomes.
Oh, I see. Because it's like, if you're less empathetic, maybe you're more willing to push through your patient's discomfort for the long-term benefit.
The argument that we have is that is specifically true when it comes to one component of empathy called affect sharing. So the extent uh-huh. to which you really resonate with and get kind of stressed uh-huh. out about touching a spider, or, you know, embarrassing yourself in public, or, you know, wiping your hands along a toilet bowl. Like, the more you share that patient's distress, the more likely you are to try to escape the exposure, which downregulates their affect in the short term, but it only reinforces the idea that they have to be terrified of X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. And so really you need to, as a good effective mm-hmm. exposure therapist, downregulate your affect sharing. You have to have mm-hmm. less of that component of empathy mm-hmm. in order to help push your help your patient fully come into contact with the thing that they're afraid of in order to learn that they can handle these situations.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What would the other component or components of empathy be in this model?
So Jamil has a lot of great data behind these, his kind of three components, as well as, you know, a lot of other folks in the field. Empathy was the quote. There's just as many definitions of empathy as there are scholars who research it, you know? yeah. But we're working within this tripartite model of affect sharing. So how much you really kind of feel the same feelings as other people, mentalizing, how much you are kind of representing the mental contents of someone else mm-hmm. and seeing the world through their eyes, and empathic concern, how driven you are to improve the kind of well-being of someone else. Mm-hmm. Those three things are obviously related and they're under the umbrella of empathy, but you can separate them mm-hmm. three distinct parts.
Yeah. Do you think these types of clinical models, are they more functionally oriented? So for example, if two concepts are highly related, and there's an argument for saying maybe that's a unidimensional construct, and then there's an argument for saying, well, maybe if we split it up into these subtypes, we can answer more specific questions. Does it all boil down to what the function is? Like, if you get more functionality out of some sort of differentiating the concept, then that's usually the motivation for it.
I would say that there are both. I'm understanding what you're saying as, does the clinical field lump more or does it split more? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say there are lumpers and splitters within the field. Yeah. There are some people really motivated and let's make more disorders and more clinical types and more other things. There are other people that are like, no, let's have one dimension. Let's have, you know, and there's a debate.
Yeah, that's kind of related to the idea of clinical diagnoses, and I'm sure there are many debates about that, but it's like, you know, depression, for example, is there such thing as depression, or are there just depressive symptoms? And it's like a spectrum where some people have less and some people have more, and I'm guessing both, but then it's like, where do you set the cutoff?
It's tricky. I've spent many years thinking and writing and talking about all of that, though I'm not personally, you know, doing scholarship on that. We're talking about a lot in the field.
Right. And I think it would be interesting to talk about the interaction between your translational work and the language work. So for example, if people with depression are more biased towards using negative language or language that doesn't help them respond, even if it's like the same emotion or the same stimulus, it's like the coping mechanisms might be different.
Yeah, well, here's where I feel really excited about one arm of my research on a related question, which is that linguistic distancing. So this started by doing laboratory studies of people regulating their emotions. So we gave them pictures and we said, think about these images differently, kind of reinterpret them in order to feel better about them, regulate your emotional responses, but write down what you're thinking and while you're doing this. And mm-hmm. what popped out is when people regulate, they spontaneously use the word I and other first person singular pronouns less, uh-huh. and they use present tense verbs less, and they use past and future tense verbs more. They shift their attention away from themselves in the present moment towards, you know, broader targets, other people, other times. And the extent to which people do this correlates with how effective they are at changing their feelings. So we have this linguistic distancing as a metric of how well people are regulating their emotions. In other studies, we then showed that just distancing your language, write about this image, but don't use the word I, helps people feel better. So you can regulate your emotions by distancing your language, same with present tense verbs. We then, in my third dissertation study, we translated this to 1 million messages between patients and their therapists, 6,000 participants. We replicated within that big sample this finding that people who use more linguistic distancing are less depressed and anxious. And as you go through treatment, your language becomes more distant, such that we can kind of measure how, you know, successful treatment is for you by your language alone. So I'm so excited about this. You know, it's exactly what you were just asking about. Can we look at language to kind of identify who's struggling? Yes. And then can we maybe, this is the next kind of arm of research that I'm hoping to do in the lab, can we get patients or therapists to shift the distance of their language in order to increase the efficacy of their regulatory, you know, intervention? Really, really thrilled about that.
Yeah. And what's the theory behind that phenomenon? Because I guess I could imagine both, because maybe there could be, obviously it wouldn't fit the data, but like the alternative explanation might be something like if you're identifying more with your emotions and your surroundings, maybe that would have some benefit. And so why doesn't that have benefit?
Yeah. The idea of linguistic distancing being a helpful strategy is connected to control level theory. Trope and Lieberman have this idea that distance is encoded in the mind, and this is expanded by Tolly Wheatley, Carolyn Parkinson, encoded in the mind with lots of different dimensions all overlapping. So we knit our social group. We organize our social group along a dimension of distance. We think about spatial distance. We think about time as all along distance. And as you move up one dimension, they all kind of travel together. And affective intensity is also encoded in this way. When we think of things as close, happening right here, right now to us, or our closest kind of social ties, then we have stronger emotions. And when we move things further away from us on any dimension, our affect goes down and we get a better ability to kind of rethink or reimagine what these situations mean. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the only one who's shown this kind of use of I language correlates with depression, anxiety, psychopathology. There's actually meta-analyses showing that. So writ large, being able to separate from yourself and see yourself at some distance seems to be helpful, having less intense emotions and rethinking managing those emotions better. Mm-hmm. That is not to say one should never use the word I, or one should only, you know, speak away from the present moment. I think flexibility is going to be very important. And I think there might be the right tool. You need the right tool for the job, depending on what context mm-hmm. you're in. That said, as a main effect, we're finding more distance mm-hmm. languages.
So would the linguistic distance be particularly useful for negative emotions or negative stimuli, but then it's like for positive things, you would want to identify more with them so you experience positive things more positively?
It's a great hypothesis. And I think there's one paper, I'm blanking on who wrote it, showing that when you ask people to recall memories, depressed participants use the word I more for negative memories and less for positive memories compared to controls. So yeah, I think that being more connected to positive affect might actually be a helpful intervention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. Does this have anything to do with like someone's internal monologue? So for example, if you're thinking, maybe an I statement would be more default, but then if you have chores to do and you have a voice in your head that's saying you need to do this, and it's not necessarily I need to do this, at least I experienced that personally.
Yeah, this is the segue. A lot of my research is, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants in many different regards. I could talk about lots of people, but right now I'll talk about Ethan Cross. He's done a lot of research on psychological distancing as a helpful strategy, and was just dipping into the kind of language side of things as I was also running these studies. And so we, you know, he was on my committee. He's been such a strong support of this line of research. Yeah, when he talks about his findings, which also show that distancing your language is helpful for you, he talks about exactly what you described. Go do this thing, or like, you got this, you know, has a different impact psychologically than, oh my God, what if I, you know, fail everyone? You know, it's a different.
Right. Yeah. It kind of reminds me of like Freudian ideas, because it's almost like we have these multiple selves. There's like the internal version of you that wants you to be responsible and do your chores. And then there's like the other more reluctant side of you. And it's like, so we have like these multiple personalities. That's more lay psychology though.
Yeah, maybe. Or a dynamic formulation. Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned this linguistic distance research being one major focus of your new lab that you're starting at Princeton. Are there any other future research directions that you're excited about that you want to talk about?
So many, too many. I am just so thrilled by this next chapter. It's going to be really, really exciting. And the directions I go, I'm so pleased to have a great team who are going to come in with me. And where we go next is going to be very strongly shaped by their ideas and interests. Mm-hmm. One direction I want to go in is extending this linguistic distancing research to interpersonal contexts, right? So what is the therapist's language doing to our patients, and how can we best train therapists to use their language effectively in treatment? Another direction I'm excited about is following up on this really bizarre finding from my undergrad years with Kevin Oxner and Ajay Sapate, showing that when you ask people to label what they're feeling right before they regulate, they are worse at regulating their emotions, which was the opposite of what I expected and what other people in the field have hypothesized, and also what we often do clinically. And so we ran that study 2 times plus a pilot. They all showed the same things, but there's so many contextual moderators that potentially could explain why maybe labeling your emotions is helpful when you do it with someone else, or when you follow up a week later, or, you know, I want to explore all of those things. I also, with Leah Somerville, who was my PhD supervisor, is going to be your PhD supervisor, have a line of research looking at how kids and teenagers learn about emotion language. And I want to follow up that line of work, figuring out more kind of when do these concepts come online, what's helping to bootstrap healthy emotion representation regulation and kids and teenagers, more on the social neuroscience or affective neuroscience of all of this. How do individual differences in emotion representation map into kind of specificity of neural representation? There's a lot of directions to go. Yeah,
we haven't really talked about development in this conversation. Are there any standout findings from your work with Leah that you want to mention?
Yeah. There are one big one is that, you know, we asked, we measured how specifically people represent their emotions. So some people have this really fine grained, high granularity in their emotions. They know how these outer ring emotions you talk about, disappointment versus frustration versus annoyance. They know exactly how those things differ. Other people really struggle to make those fine grained distinctions. They're like, I don't know, I felt bad then, and I felt bad then, and I felt bad then. It was all bad. Yeah. And what we measured this across, age is 5 to 25, I think. And you actually find this U-shape relationship of emotion differentiation across age. Mm-hmm. Kids have this process where they say, you know, I feel sad and no other emotions. I feel angry and no other emotions. And that gives them actually a very granular sense of how they're feeling in each moment. They have high differentiation. Mm-hmm. As you go into adolescence, people start to co-experience emotions. I felt angry and sad and kind of upset and a little grossed out. And I don't really know right now how those all differ from each other. They're kind of muddled.
Right.
And then when you move into young adulthood, you can both co-experience emotions, but have a more fine-grained understanding of them. So mm-hmm. I like that finding because I think it just puts data to experience a lot of us have, which is both mm-hmm. when we are teenagers and when we're interacting with teenagers, there's this kind of confluence of different emotions, and it can be really difficult to figure out one from the other. That seems to be a normative process that emerges from this new experience of co-experiencing emotions.
Yeah, this is another one of those things where it seems like higher granularity is better. But is that always the case? Are there any advantages to having less emotion differentiation?
It is a very good question. Right now, all the data that we have seems to suggest that higher differentiation is better. Mm-hmm. But I would not be surprised if there is a little bit of a reversal on folks who say are kind of obsessive over how they're feeling or are very anxious about figuring out how they're feeling. If you get into that kind of preoccupation, then I could say it would be unhelpful. But mm-hmm. for instance, some of my own data with Kate McLaughlin, as well as Lisa Starr at Rochester, have shown that people, whether you're a teenager or an adult, if you have higher differentiation and you experience stress, you're buffered from that stress. You're less likely to develop anxiety or depression than if you have low emotion differentiation ability.
Uh-huh. Do you think that might have anything to do with like attributing cause? So for example, if you just feel bad generally and you don't know why, then maybe it's like the world is bad and it's out to get me. But then if you can point to a specific cause, it's like the problem is more narrow.
That absolutely sign off on. And many other processes, right? you might have more sophisticated regulatory abilities. You might have better fitting regulatory abilities. I also wrote my only solo author paper is a review of emotion differentiation in youth. And I talk about these findings, and a big problem in our scientific understanding of this phenomenon is, what if there's a third variable out there? What if it's just people with higher IQ, both have better differentiation and more sophisticated ways of regulating their emotions, and those mm-hmm. two things aren't connected to each other at all. So it's really important to rule that out.
Uh-huh. Right, yeah. So has your work both on emotional development and your clinical experience learning about different habits people can build for experiencing better emotional life, has that made you more optimistic about what people can do in their everyday life to have better well-being?
What a lovely question. I am very optimistic about the ability for therapy to help people. Mm-hmm. That is something that I feel, both being a therapist and being a patient in therapy, mm-hmm. has just helped me feel so committed to. mm-hmm. And you know, therapy can be really hard, and some people's problems aren't going to go away easily. But so if you're struggling, you're out there listening, you're struggling, that's okay. I'm not saying there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that you can find cognitive behavioral skills and tools to help you change aspects of your life. And that is just so beautiful to observe in my patients. And I have definitely experienced a transformation within my own life and how anxious and compulsive I am about many different things, and my ability to manage relationships and things like that because of an exposure to therapeutic skills, as well as a commitment to really trying them out. So that I feel a lot of optimism for. And there are just so many clinicians out there and clinical scientists out there doing good work, not only to refine the interventions we have, but also to increase their access. We have a huge access problem where, you know, some people for all sorts of socio-demographic reasons are not engaged with therapy. And so we really need to, you know, that I think that's a huge frontier if we're actually gonna help make a dent in the global burden of psychopathology. We just need to help more people get involved in the skills that are going to help them.
Yeah. From a historical perspective, psychotherapy is surprisingly new. I mean, we've had it for more or less the last 100 years, right? Do you think that it's something like everyone needs this type of interpersonal dialogue, but that normally you get it through friends and family? Or is there something aside from the like the cognitive training that clinicians provide that you couldn't get from having just close relationships that you can, people you can confide in?
I think the answer to your question depends on the clinical profile of the person. For a lot of instances, yes, it's sufficient to have a supportive group around you of people who are coaching you through it. But I think there are also conditions where, you know, there are tools that therapy provides, and also psychopharmacology could provide that is really valuable beyond just having a supportive network. Yeah.
What a lovely positive message to end on. Thank you so much for your time, Eric.
Of course, it's been really, really fun. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.